We are moving into the Rav's interpretations moving into Pesach of his connection to Shir HaShirim. And until now, we were doing the Rav on Purim through Megillas Esther. Now we're going to be doing the Rav on Pesach vis-a-vis his comments on Shir HaShirim. Now, Shir HaShirim is the book that we read on Pesach, because it's not only about the springing of young love, which of course it's a rejuvenation, it's the rebudding of nature, but Shir HaShirim also represents the aspiration of the Jewish people to enhance their relationship with God. A relationship that is on the rocks and up and down. It has its crests and we'll see through the storyline itself, and that's the nature of God's relationship with His people. We start our nationhood in exile. Right? Why do we have to start in exile? The book begins as if though the female character is missing something. Kami shali lo natarti. I didn't have a chance to tend my own vineyard. I've been darkened by the sun. She speaks as if though she's working for someone else. She it seems to be enslaved. She's working so hard that the sun beats down on her and darkens her skin and parches her skin. So we just start from the very beginning, is that Chazal understood this love story, this 8-chapter love story, as not simply an unfortunate story about a man and a woman who can't seem to love each other at the same time. They're clearly so in love. Every time each one professes love for the other's not interested. Right? What could be more sad than this? But they're clearly very much in love with each other. And the woman in question is Bnei Yisrael in the parable. And the man in question is, of course, God. And their names are even the same. They're similar, at least. Is the woman's name is Shulamit in the story? Shulamit. The man's name is Shlomo. They have to be somewhat similar. It's a feminized name of Shlomo. So the understanding of Chazal is that this is a parable of the long history between God and His people, beginning with our national, we begin as a nation in slavery, in exile, right? The first time we referred to as an Am B'nai Yisrael is by Paro, who evaluates our status, Ein Am B'nai Yisrael, Rava Atzum Mimenu, Hava Nitchak Malo, etc., etc. So we become a nation under the most adverse of circumstances. It seems that the reason why the Jewish people and this country share so much of its basic core values is because we both start our nationhood in the attempt to break off the bonds of tyranny and to try to find liberty out of that tyranny. So I've heard this, the founding fathers were very much enamored with the Yetzias Mitzrayim story, and they wanted to make the insignia of the new country the picture of the red party of the Red Sea. You know, they see the water like this with Moshe with his hands up. Instead, the eagle one with the eagle carrying some arrows in one hand and some branches in another. But they did put a Jewish star. The 13 colonies make up a Jewish star in the insignia. So, be it as it may, we begin as a nation under these most harrowing of circumstances. And Shir HaShirim begins with that element, where the woman says, I have been unable to tend to my own my own vineyards because I've been tending to the vineyards of the Egyptians, building edifices I'll never live in, reaping harvests I'll never eat. So she's been doing things for others, and that's the beginning of the relationship. Shir HaShirim is not the only book in Tanakh that does this. May I suggest, take a few, this is homework I'm giving you, to read Yechezkel chapter 16. It's the largest chapter in Yechezkel. I'm giving you homework. And you'll see it's mamash the same thing. It starts earlier, right? It seems to start like an earlier age. The woman here in the parable is in love, so she's of age. In the parable in Yechezkel, are you familiar with it? You have it there, Nate?
I can
pull it up. Okay, but Yechezkel 16 begins with the parable, the woman in the parable as a baby, as an infant.
Right.
I'm sure you're familiar with it from the Seder. It's quoted quite often in, towards the the end of the Shenemar part. It possesses b'domayich, b'malach b'domayichayi, b'malach b'domayichayi. She's it's like a mamish, a newborn baby, minutes away from the womb, left in the basket. The umbilical cord is still attached to her. Right? I hope you're getting the parable, right? Right. So the parable is that in our infant stages as a nation, no one wanted us. We were set aside by power, and not one nation came to our aid. And even after all the miracles, why do you think no one came to greet us with bread and water? No one wanted to affect their relationship with the Egyptians.
They
were very much underwater, and still no one wanted to help these people that just, you'd think, put some stock in these people, help them. No. You're still alone.
Well, it isn't anti-Semitic canard, but you'd be afraid of
powerful. The only one nation that seemed that had any Shemets of is Midian, and that's from this week's Haftorah, where Shaul tells the Amalekim, tells the Cani, you did chesed with our ancestors when we left Egypt. The chesed is not quite clear. Is it that Yisro's advice is the chesed? Is that he gave them a nice meal? What's the chesed? Chesed Mistama is that Midian was the one nation whose leader said, Baruch Hashem, Asher Yitzil, Hashem Yad Mitzrayim, Yad Paro. Everyone else was afraid to say something like that. Be that as it may, the issue at hand is that we're always profoundly alone, and no one wants to touch this baby. Baby's left to die. A baby like that is going to die in the first day of life if no one comes and gives her food and swaddles her. And so here is that now that. It's God, of course, but he says, and I took that basket, and I took you, I cut your umbilical cord, and I washed you, and he salted, we laughed at you. He probably means some kind of a salve, or some kind of a bathing solution. And I salted you, and I swaddled you, and I warmed you, and I raised you, and I gave you, and I taught you, I gave you perfumes, and then, and you blossomed into a princess, a beautiful woman. And then you went and played the harlot with all the various men after all I did for you. Now, in the parable in Yechezkel, it's not, Yechezkel is not like Shir HaShirim, because Shir HaShirim is pure, you have to get the mashmaut of Yechezkel, of Shir HaShirim, I'm sorry. In Yechezkel, the male in the story goes from being like a father figure to an infant, right? To a potential loving husband.
Yes.
Right? So God appears someplace, sometimes in Tanakh as our father, and sometimes in Tanakh as our beloved. Think of Sefer Hosea. In all of these parables, it's very clear what the parable is meant to convey. Right? God tells Hosea to marry a famous harlot and have children with her, and you're not even sure if they're your children. Right? The harlot is Bnei Israel, which Hosea is like God. And nonetheless, I still, with all of your harlotry, I still stay with you and I still consider you to be mine. Yirmiyahu, I'll end it here. It's really Hoshea, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel. Hoshea, Yirmiyahu in chapter 3 of his book. Listen to this. He went over and asked Shiloh, guys, come on. I have a question for you. If Reuven marries Rachel, and then he divorces her, and then Rachel marries Shimon, and then Shimon dies, can Reuven marry her again? Right, you know this law, right? Mm-hmm. If a woman is divorced from a husband,
no.
And then she marries another man, she may never go back to the original husband. Right? So Yirmiyahu says, okay, now you're in big trouble. Because God divorced you. He sent you into exile. He's referring, that's in Yeshayahu. But Venasati lost Sefer Krisusev, and I warned her, don't go to other gods afterwards, because I'll take you back. But how can I take you back now? Because you went to other play with the harlot with other gods. Just as an interesting sign of the way of the world, the New Testament. The New Testament has a book called the Book of Hebrews, which is dedicated to showing why God has to choose a new Israel. Because the old Hebrews, the old Israel, doesn't deserve God's graces anymore. Right? So it has to be like a new Israel. Right? And the chapter 8 of this book of Hebrews is chapter 3 of Yirmiyahu. But they don't quote the part of the chapter that says, in spite of the fact that you went to other gods, I will take you back. Anybody remember what when? Ki chosid ani. Because I'm a chosid. If you know, you could picture, if he was a pure Litvak, he would say, I can't, how can I take you back? It's against the halacha, you know. Right? But the chassid knows, you know, when I could be lifting Mishur Sadin. Right? You get it? So anyway, so Yirmiyahu is also playing this parable game of God being the husband, Israel being the wife.
Isn't that a motif, bro? We always compare God to a Hapa and Hala and to a woman.
Yeah, so it would appear that in the Torah, that in our early part of our history, God is unequivocally taking care of us, even if you complain by the man and you complain. He's like a father. You can't unfather a father, but you can unhusband a husband. Right? So what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was trying to do, and I think that the transition book is Bamidbar, what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to do is transition us from being like a child before God. And the child can get a patch and the child can get disciplined to be like a loving spouse. Husband doesn't want to discipline his spouse. They're on equal terms. They're horizontal. They're not father-child. They're on similar levels where I have more expectations of you. A husband certainly has more expectations of his wife and the wife has more expectations of her husband than they might have of their children. What do I expect from my children? I expect you to honor me. I expect you to do chores. But I'm responsible for, you know, your rent, your children are good socialists because they can't.
The parental love also, it's immediate. Like if a kid appeared, that's it. You're immediately with the kid. Right,
of course.
They have no personality, right, so, no character, no quality, nothing.
It's all coming from the parents.
That's it. That's right.
So the man and the wife are on a horizontal level. This might explain, and this the Rav did in one of the Reflections of the Rav. Have you been starting to read the whole thing, or you just saw that one article?
No, I only read the
try to get the whole thing. It's just really amazing. But he has one on the Meraglim, right? The scouts that went into the land that felt that we can't. What Mishagas got into their head? The God who just dispatched these Egyptians, and they said themselves just a few months earlier, Namogu kol yoshvei kena'an, tipol aleihem emasav afachad, bigdol zruachal yimuka oven, right? Elei mo'av yochazem ra'ad, Namogu kol yoshvei. What's going on here? What is the, what was their basic fear? So what happened, this is the way the Rav explained it, is that it didn't take long, just about a year in the desert, for them to become so dependent on God, like a child, right, for their food, their man, for their drink, their water, the air, and their, you know, the Torah describes, and the protection from the clouds and the fire, But the Torah also later, not in Shmos, but in Devarim, in review, describes your shoes didn't grow. Your clothes didn't. Right, your clothes didn't get patched, and everything just was perfect for you. The clouds and the fire in the clouds protected them to such an extent. So they became so dependent on that they could not fathom entering the land and actually behaving like a husband and wife, because they got so used to behaving like children. They say this, about slaves, that I don't want to go free.
But no, but that's the same thing, because they were reliving the slave experience,
right, slave mentality,
and everything. That's why they said we were in their eyes, we were like brothers.
Right.
They're projecting their own
experience. Right. Remember, they said we felt like grasshoppers. Remember that sound familiar? We felt like grasshoppers in front of the people. They were so tall, and then they project themselves, and that's what they thought of us.
Right.
Right. In reality, when Rachav, in the Haftorah of that Torah reading, right, when Rachav talks to them, and he said, "No, we're the ones afraid of you guys," right? So it's unfortunate, but what's fascinating is, and this I'm now projecting onto the Rav, is that the three mitzvahs that immediately follow the fiasco with the Meraglim seem to be very much disjointed. They seem to be very much, why are we mentioning this? One is actually already mentioned earlier in the Torah. One is the libations, the nesachim, libations that accompany korbanos. Why is that here? Why mention libations right after they were told that they would have to live out the next 40 years in the desert? Libations, challah, removing challah from the dough, and tzitzis. What is tzitzis? No, what is tzitzis in Parsha Shlach?
That was a sorrow. They were talking to a sorrow.
Okay, yes. That's because what they were doing was like a chazaku mimenu, was like a total uprooting of everything.
Right.
Like kofar beikar. So that's why we're getting tzitzis. You look at the tzitzis, remember all the mitzvahs. Because the way they acted was rejection of all the mitzvahs. They weren't about the nesachim and the challah, so I'd like to suggest that the three main categories of things they got in the desert that was so miraculous was the man, the be'er, and the clouds protection that kept the clothes from and the general protection from the elements. So each one of these mitzvahs can really correspond. Because you go to Israel and you give nesachim, the be'er is not going to follow you, but you know what? Limtara shemayim tishtemayim. You don't really have a great body of water like the land your father came from, which is the Euphrates, nor the land where you just spent the last 200 years, which is the Nile, right? You don't have that in Israel. You got a nice Mediterranean, but that's not going to do it for you. There's a nice Kinneret up north, and there are some other bodies of water as well. There's the Jordan, but it's not enough. You are dependent on which is a good thing. In Egypt, you just make tributaries and put your feet over and go and water your garden. But in Israel, you have to rely on the heavens. So that's the nesachim. You bring your nesachim, I'll take care of it. I just saw such a nice vort on that from this week's parasha. Are you familiar with the fact that maybe I'll talk about it Friday night, so I mentioned I don't want to spoil it. So it's that if we live at a time where we can't bring korbanot, then just reciting them or learning Maseches Vachim is as if though you brought the korban. Just reciting it is as if though I had to bring a chatos, I had to bring a sin offering, Thanksgiving offering, just reading about it is as if though you. Where do we see that? I mean, if I read about giving charity, it's as if I give charity. If I read about tefillin, it's as if though I'm wearing tefillin. What does that even mean?
It's the thoughts.
So because when it comes to korbanos, you're not giving God the meat. You're not giving God the wine. You're not giving God the blood and the fat. And you're not giving these things to God. You're going through certain motions, yes, but God doesn't need this. So it's Parshas Tzav, and it's worthy to talk about this, but it's a tangent to what we're doing. But what's interesting is that when it says the Nesachim, if you hear what the Gemara just says, read about it, learn about it. But how do you give Nesachim? How do you Nesachim and libations? The Gemara doesn't say read about the libations and it's if though you brought it. And see, the Gemara says buy wine for a poor person for Havdalah and Kiddush. And that's as if though you brought Nesachim. So it's well, Kasha, why not just say Nesachim is part of the sacrificial order? So read about the Nesachim. It's as if though you brought Nesachim. So I saw this very, very nice diuk. Is that by all the Karbanos, it says Zos Toras Hachatos, Zos Toras Ha'ola, Zos to, right? So it's okay that we learn from that. So when you read the words of the Torah, it's as if though you brought the chatos. But it never says Zos Toras HaNesachim. So you have to do more than read about the Nesachim to be giving the Nesachim. You have to.
Where that is.
But the Mahane Atam Chacham.
No. If you're, you have to bring give the wine to a poor person.
Yeah. I'd have to find that, but I think Howard, I'm so sorry, but I never like to be caught without. I'll have to look into that.
That's really great.
It's so great. It's a poor Talmud Chacham. I think it has to be something learned about.
Well, but I get it. Yeah, that's what you're doing instead of using.
Right, and then the tzitzis is the protection. In other words, the challah is connected to man. You give challah, and I'll bless the land. You give nesachim, and I'll bless the rain. And you wear your tzitzis, and I'll give you protection. Those are not guarantees, but nonetheless, that's why the Meraglim continue like that. Okay, let's now. So Shir HaShirim is a sefer that accentuates this loving relationship. And I would like to suggest to you that Rashi added one little word to his introduction to Shir HaShirim, which he never uses any other time when defining this kind of issue, because I'll tell you the sentence in a second. You'll recognize it in a moment. And yet, only in Shir HaShirim he adds this one word. The statement is "Ein mikra yotze midei pshuto." Very famous line. Rashi uses it over 100 times. Mm-hmm. It means when you render an understanding or a translation of a biblical text, you must not refrain from interpreting it in its simplest form.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Not dig deeper into the meaning of that text until you give the simple meaning of the text. Now, it's true that one text may have multiple meanings. That's the point. Achati bero kim shtayim zu shamati. Right? Now, I've done this exercise with you in different ways over time. But what Rashi does in Shir HaShirim is, he says, everybody who reads this story must appreciate that ein mikra yotze midei pshuto umashma'o. He never says that. Now, pshat is the simple meaning. Drash is the deeper meaning. What's mashma'ut? What's the mashma'ut of a word, of a statement?
Honestly, it's not quite the opposite, but it's implying something deeper than
Pshat or something. But then it means something in between Pshat and Drash? Pshat cannot be the same as Mashmut, because Rashi sometimes writes Pshuto ke Mashma'o. What does he mean when he says that? Pshuto ke Mashma'o.
Aziz.
Good. Aziz is a good way to say it. Mashma'ut. Mashma'uto. But I'm going to give you the way scholars usually interpret it, and a Hebrew speaker is probably going to be good at determining it. But then you can just press the envelope further. Mashma'ut means the verbal meaning of the word. But then that just presses the question. You can look up a word in the dictionary and see three or four verbal meanings. Ah, but wait.
Sharash?
Sharash will be helpful for sure. The root of the word will be helpful in figuring out what the word means. But let's say for an example, Vayisrotzitzu habanim bekirba.
Right.
Right.
Sounds like
Rivka's children. She doesn't even know she has two yet, but it says the children Vayisrotzitzu bekirba. So in its plain meaning, what does that mean?
They were fighting.
They were struggling.
Sorry.
Okay, those are. Fighting and running are two different shorashim in Hebrew. One is resh vav tzadik, which means to run. One is resh tzadik tzadik, which means to struggle. So Rashi actually gives two perushim to capture the essence of both, but both are not pshat. What would you say is the pshat of Vayisro Tetsu HaBanim B'Kirba, which is what Rashbam writes? Yes. Yes, they're kicking inside her. It's exactly what he writes.
That's good.
Right? It says, Hayu misna'anim v'rotzim besoch me'eho kiderech ubrim.
Yeah, exactly.
Kiderech, he loves the word kiderech. Rishpam loves the word kiderech. Kiderech ubrim.
Right.
One baby inside is going to give you a good kick here and there. Right. Certainly two. They're jockeying for space. They're moving around, right? It gives an interesting foreshadowing about the way they would be after they're born. But Vayisro Tetsua Banim B'Kirba seems to be, would you agree, in Pshat, is just describing a normal, natural occurrence, especially not just with one baby, but certainly with two.
Right, yes.
What's the problem with the Pshat, though?
She said the Shulam is not
open. Rashi writes that. But I think what Rashi really means is not just that she said why not just lamazeli would be why is this happening to me, lamazenochi is like a really deep question, because it's a Hamlet kind of question. Why do I even exist? Right? Can you really chop it? Because this will go a long way to figuring out the way Rashi works. It's not just what made Rivka say this? Maybe Rivka, look, she's waiting 20 years to become pregnant. Right?
Yeah, but she might have thought there's a rift. With
right? So this is, the Rashi means to tell us that there was never a pregnancy on the history of man like this one. But it's more than that. It's not just...
Yeah, he tore her womb up.
What? Yes, it is a measure.
She
yes.
Kind of more
yes. So, but it's not just what made her react to this extent. Can you really chop it? It's not just what made Rivka react this way. What made the Torah even write this? Mm-hmm. If this was a common occurrence for women.
Yes, yeah, excellent point.
That's what Rashi's writing. Why is this written in the Torah? God could have just come to her. She's barren. They waited 20 years to have a child. And they just say, Vatah Rivka Ishto, Vayomer Hashem Lo. Shnei goyim bevidneich. Guess why, Rivka, you're having twins. We don't even have to know that Vayisro Tetsua b'nim b'kirba v'atomim kenu mezenochi v'telek v'droshes Hashem. So, but do you see that there's the pshat?
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes, as Rashbam, he always gives you the pshat, the deeper pshat. And Rashi says, this pshat leaves me with a headache. It leaves me with a pain. It leaves me with, this is just the Torah, which is, by the way, it was a tough pregnancy. Let me tell you a little more about it. No, text has to be more significant than that if this is just a normal occurrence. Okay, clear? All right, so I think that when in humor, or maybe in advertisements, they sometimes you have like a double meaning of something.
Sure.
Right. I'll give you a quick example of this. I didn't know this, but I heard it in a writing course I took in college. the teacher showed us an ad in case some of us wanted to go to write for ad agencies, and it said this vodka will leave you breathless. Mm-hmm. Okay, what's the pshat of that?
No breath.
Yeah,
dead.
No breath.
Smell it. You know that about vodka?
Yeah, it's yes.
Yes, vodka is different than all other alcoholic beverages. Is that if you've been drinking beer, wine, scotch, bourbon, it's detected on your breath.
Vodka? Except vodka. Except vodka, yeah.
And the better the vodka is, the more it's not on your breath. So this vodka will leave you breathless. Now, you needed to know something about vodka to get that interpretation, right? You might not have known that. So would you agree that breathless is, oh, this is so good, I can't catch my breath. Now, breathless can also mean dead, but I can't believe that someone would pay an ad agency money to teach people how to commit suicide by drinking a poisonous vodka. What it means is this vodka will leave you catching your breath. It's so good.
Yes, it's also some of the context of the story or the sentence.
But people know that, because that's not the case.
So the key is that, but you had to know that. So that becomes a drash. It becomes a higher level cognitive thinking.
I would have to say there's three levels of meaning there, because it really does want to connect death with vodka. Great leader, Ogilvy, David Ogilvy, he writes in his book, Ogilvy on Advertising, all the symbols of death that are in skulls that are in like the ice cubes and everything like that. They want you to do that for some reason.
But there's also a connection.
That's a possibility, right?
They want you to connect it with death.
Death?
Yes, for some reason.
Why?
I have to go back and reread it, but he made it.
Because it's a possibility.
So that this, you can live by taking this?
No, turn away from death by
drinking our vodka.
Well, actually, there is a tension in literature between orgasm and death. It's a common literary motif. So they're trying to.
I'll go back and look at it, but he makes a big point of it.
Okay, fine. So maybe there's even three layers of
that.
All right, but you see that in advertisements, and certainly in humor, right? Yes, it's meant to. There's a pshat and there's a drash, but it's important to have a few exercises in this so that you see where Shir HaShirim is going to go, right?
I don't know why they say that though, because Shir HaShirim, even the drash level is complicated. They say
I know, but what the Rashi I think is telling us
be simple
is that you can certainly want to get the parable. But you will be shortened, you'll be cheating yourself of the parable
if you don't read the
this passionate love between two humans.
Well, following what you're saying, if no reason, if it's just about humans, why would you include it?
Of course. That's it. Yes.
It's the interplay.
There were some Tanoim who thought it doesn't belong in Tanakh.
Right.
Perhaps for that very reason. And so Rabbi Akiva said, no, you're making a mistake. This is the holiest part of the Bible, because anything that enhances the love between God and his people is Kodesh Kadoshim. So I think that's what Rashi is telling us here. Okay. A mushroom walks into a bar and says, may I have a drink? And the bartender says, sorry, we don't serve your kind here. And he said, why not? I'm a fun guy. Well, thank you for okay, so but which one is the pshat and which one is the drash? So I'm a fun guy is the pshat. In other words, you like to have fun guys in a bar, right? Other people will want to drink also, and they'll come in and they'll have a good time, right? But why wouldn't you serve a guy like me? I'm a fun guy. But do you know that F-U-N-G-H-I is a mushroom?
Mold. Yeah.
Mushroom is a fungi. Anyway, so that's it's puns. Yeah. No, you just go.
That was funny.
Okay.
Funny.
Okay.
That is funny.
All right. So when you read a parable, right, there's a parable from, I think the most famous parable in the entire Bible is where a prophet tells David that there's a rich man And the poor man in your kingdom. Sing familiar?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the rich man has many wives. The poor man has only one wife.
One sheep.
Oh, when I say
one
the rich
sheep.
Man has many sheep. The poor man has just one sheep that he loves and he adores. And it goes a little too far. Too much information about how close he is with the sheep. So he says that, and one time, but here's really the upshot of the whole story, is that one day a halech, I think I got the word right, a halech, which means a passerby. A halech came to the rich man, and the rich man didn't want to give one of his many sheep to give to the oreach. Now he's all of a sudden, this halech is now a guest, to the oreach who came to his house. Instead, he took the one lone sheep of that poor man and slaughtered it and presented it before, now it's to the el ha'ish asher ba'ilav. It's all one pasuk. Halech, oreach, ish. So the Gemara in Sukkah says, I'm giving it away now by telling which Masechta it's in. The Gemara at the end of Sukkah says, the rich man is David. The poor man is Uriah. The many sheep are David's many wives. The poor one sheep is Bathsheba. Who's this guest?
Hashem? I don't know.
It's
Yetzirah,
yes. That was the arrow, the Cupid's arrow.
The end of Sukkah is a big sugi in Shas on Yetzirah to explain why they had to separate the men and the women in the Simchas Pesach Shoeva. So the Gemara gets off on a huge tangent on Yetzirah. So the Yetzirah always starts off as a halach, just passes by. Now, sometimes we invite the Yetzirah in ourselves. You go looking online and you're looking for something and you invite the Yetzirah in. But many times the Yetzirah just comes in sort of by accident. He walks by and David didn't go looking for Bathsheba. He was walking on his roof and maybe she shouldn't have been. The Gemara says she was behind a screen that blew away in the wind. All right, but be that as it may, the Yetzirah always starts off as a halach thing. If we don't banish it, it's easier to banish when it's just a halach. But if we don't banish it in time, it becomes no reach, who you can still, send home. But once he becomes an ish, he's like paying rent. He's in your head, right? It's very hard to banish him at that stage. So especially if you're a king and you're used to getting what you want, right? But these are all parables. So in the parable, for instance, the man and the woman are extremely explicit when describing each other. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. You've read it. They go up and down each other's bodies twice in this book without missing anything, right? From head to toe, okay? How this got into the Bible and how it stays in the Bible is amazing. So what Art Scrolls does is it just omits the whole thing. Right. It does mention it at the bottom. It does give a translation.
Who has the real Shem?
It's absurd.
Where's the real one? Unadulterated.
For the Koren, the JPS, Sansino, they all give it straight out.
Okay.
But I'm pretty sure that the traditional press up there also does the same thing, and the arts, the traditional press, they all tell you that in the translation, the two staves of the Aron are very firm, and they're right. I gave it away. The two staves of the Aron are the two breasts that. They stick through the paroches. It compares it to that. Yes. So the these translations just skip over the simple pshat. So
not translations.
So not really translations. They were meant to be interpretations. But I think that Rashi, by inserting the word mashma'o, will say that when he talks about her beautiful teeth, for instance, he doesn't skip anything. So that he gets down, he starts from the top, and he gets up to her nose and her teeth, and her, right. So her teeth are beautiful; they're straight, and they're so. What do teeth represent? Teeth grow from within the body, right? So your teeth represent the inner beauty of the beloved, right? So, but if you skip the mashma'ut, so you could have said, your teeth are green. Why? Because grass is green, and grass also grows from within. I mean, I'm being absurd, of course, but I think what Rashi wants to tell us is that it's crucial when reading Shir HaShirim to have this passionate love, as the Rambam writes in the Mor Nebuchim and in the Mishneh Torah, that he quotes a different pasuk, interestingly, not from Shir HaShirim, but from Mishlei. Right? I'll paraphrase. He starts saying by, these books are written, Mishlei is written from the standpoint of the man, but Shir HaShirim is the woman at sometimes and the man at sometimes. Right? But Koheles. Koheles says life can be very disappointing. Life can be can cheat you out of what you think is fair. But you know what you should do? Find a man you love. But it's written as if though it's a man reading. It says, find the woman you love, and re'ei chayim ma'isha asher ahavta, and build a life together and struggle through the difficulties of life together. So if it's a woman reading the book, obviously it's anthropomorphic. So it means find a man you love, and it doesn't mean that your problems will go away, but it'll be easier to deal with them. So that man and that woman is potentially God. The Rambam says that, and he's quite explicit in the pasuk he uses, which is Ba'avasati shketamid, you know the pasuk.
I don't understand. Hashem doesn't have to work on himself.
It means that even if all else fails, with you I have everything, without you I have nothing. Now, hopefully, you can say that with some type of human love as well. But that if all else fails, that God, like David says, ki avivi imi azavuni, even if my parents would reject me, I know Hashem yasfuni, God will take me in. So your parents will will sooner reject you than your parents.
Right? It's actually abandonment. It could die or something.
Right, yeah, true. So he says, find the Yalatchein, find the beauty, the love of beauty, be smitten by her beauty, right? And I'm just going to, paraphrase though, because I'm going to say it in Hebrew. Lie between her breasts and be constantly enamored with her love. The breasts are the two luchos, the aseres adibros, ben adam b'chavero, ben adam b'makom, right? So, it's quite explicit in the pasuk, right? Mm-hmm. And yet the Rambam, he says, of course, it's talking about how to be, he's almost came out like to be meshuga.
Right, he actually said,
tishgetamid.
Then that pasuk then said, "Nikol Shir Shirim Mashal." What was that?
Right afterwards.
Right.
Did the Rav drive?
He was driven.
The stories that I heard is that the few times he drove, he was like Albert Einstein. He was like a Luftmensch. His mind got so lost and tossed by his thoughts that he would drive into a tree or something.
Impossible. I never heard that.
I heard that the Rav purposely didn't drive for that reason. And I must tell you that I purposely never listen to Torah when I drive.
Wow.
I can talk Torah when I drive, but I cannot, if I listen to Torah on the radio, I'm gonna
zone out.
Drive.
It is a zone.
And I drive to, and find out 2 hours later, where am I?
Wow.
I'm just going to, I'm going to find myself in Albany when I was meant to drive to Washington Heights.
Is it a Gemara like that too?
I suppose so. But okay, so we'll stop with this. But what I want to do next week is move in a totally different direction. Okay, because we're going to read this in Shul's in a few weeks on Pesach. So I want you to get that, it's very easy reading. Very short. Shir HaShirim is shorter than Rus. Hanami, but it's relatively easy reading. It goes back and forth. And it's a sad book. Koheles is a much happier book than Shir HaShirim.
It's very sad.
Right?
opportunities.
Yes, yes. And so here I have the translation. You probably read this in the original Hebrew, but
yeah.
This, I have this translation. It's really so thin. It's called Kol Dodi Dofek. The voice of my beloved is knocking. And the Rav spoke regarding six knocks that came upon the Jews in the 20th century. And he wrote this in the middle of the 20th century that he's hoping that we'll hear these six knocks.
Mm.
He thinks we didn't hear them in time. They were starting to knock, you know, early. And we'll see what the six knocks are. And I'm giving you homework. You're going to read Yechezkel chapter 16.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to read Shir HaShirim chapter 5. Shir HaShirim chapter 5. Including to the first pasuk of chapter 6. And we'll see chapter 5 is really a really significant historical overview of a certain relationship that the Bnei Israel have not only with God, but with the nations of the world. Okay. And Jenny, I don't hear you. Maybe you have to unmute yourself. I still don't hear you. Did you get the homework?
Chapter 16 and chapter 5 in Shir HaShirim.
Now I hear you. Chapter 16 of Yechezkel, chapter 5 of Shir HaShirim. And
the first pasuk of chapter 6.
Of chapter 6 also, yes.
I was listening.
Okay. Okay, very good. All right, so then we will, we're going to go review that, all of that next time. And we'll see that how that fits in with what the Rav said about the six knocks. Okay. Okay, everybody, have a good night.